Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 11th of Tevet. Today we're going to study a couple of different responses. Actually, they're very brief ones, so we'll see some of Cook and a couple by the Note of Yehuda. Rav Cook, as was asked about doing business with things that are prohibited, they don't define what it is. It's from the 11th of Tevet, from Tof Resh Pei He, from 1924. Actually, it was already 1925. We're at the time of the year now when you can never be sure if that date was in the year before or the main calendar year. So it's from 1925. And the question was, there's a Jew who's doing business with a non-Jew. He gives the money to a non-Jew, and the non-Jew is, they're going to be partners, and the non-Jew is going to do business with Devarim Tmeim. So Devarim Tmeim are not defined here in this Tshuva, but it'd be kinds of things that he's not supposed to be doing business with, I think. So I think he might mean things that he's not supposed to get hana'ah from, benefit from, but I'm not sure. In any case, the point is that it's something that a Jew wouldn't do business in these things. So he says it would seem to be dependent on another debate among the poskim as to whether it's only an issur d'rabbanan or an issur d'oraita. That if the things, whatever it is an issur d'oraita, is prohibited min ha-Torah, if doing business b'davar tame. So again, I'm not sure what he means by davar tame. He might mean matters of idolatry. In any case, I apologize, but I really don't. I'm just not sure. In any case, if that prohibition to do their business with those items is min ha-Torah, then you would say that you can't do it through a non-Jew as well, because it should be a shivut. A shivut meaning it should be like it's prohibited to ask a non-Jew to do business for us on Shabbos, to do anything for us on Shabbos, to do Shabbos prohibited ideas on Shabbos. We call that a shivut. Chazal said not to do it. So too, that idea of shivut applies, it should apply to any prohibitions. All right, that's the assumption of most opinions, of most poskim. And that comes from a discussion about shvut in terms of chasimba. Chasimba is when you tell an animal not to eat, or you physically stop an animal not from eating while it's plowing in a field, while it's working a field. There's an issur in the Torah to stop it. It is prohibited from the Torah to stop the animal from doing it. Usually we think of it as by a muzzle, but you can't even do chasimba by peh. And from that discussion, the Gemara Matziah, it seems like it applies to anything all right. We're not allowed to have a non-Jew do things for us. That's part of the shvut. If that's true, says Rav Cook, then it would seem to be that the rules that apply to Shabbos apply to other shivutim, to other occasions where we're not going to allow ourselves to have a non-Jew act for us, a non-Jew do things for us. And that would mean then, though, that just like in the case of Shabbos, we say that if you have a shvut to shvut, if it's two derabbanans, meaning you're going to ask a non-Jew to do a derabbanan for you, so in Shabbos cases, if there are certain needs, become tzorech, you can do it. Right, so that's a question for Shabbos purposes that he's not getting into. He's just putting it to a general principle, and where exactly that applies or not is not our topic right now. But if you can do it there in terms of Shabbos purposes, you can do it with a shvut to shvut two levels. So too, you'd say that if there's a hefsed, that's a tzorech, a serious loss of money might be a hefsed, and therefore the loss of profit here might be as well, and that could be considered a tzorech gadol. In other words, then if the prohibition of getting benefit from whatever the item is, of this davar tameh, is derabanan, then also it should be that if you have a non-Jew do it for you, and it's a matter of losing a lot of profit, it should be all right. That's his first salvo into the discussion. Problem is, he says it doesn't quite work. He says that it makes some sense, but we find in terms of doing malach on Chol HaMoed, so we say that you can't have a non-Jew it for you, and it sounds there that they don't make such a distinction between whether it's a reshut or dvar mitzvah, whether it's a matter of mitzvah. There, a matter of mitzvah, we usually say on Shabbos purposes that if it's two derabbanan, it's a derabbanan, and we're asking a non-Jew to do a derabbanan for us, that it should be okay. Whereas for just a dvar reshut, for something that we just is a matter of whether we want to or not, we have no mitzvah need to do it, we say not. Same thing. Speak about the difference between a tzorech katan and a tzorech gadol, and there too, we don't speak about it in terms of Chol HaMoed. So, in other words, that seems to go against the principle he just laid out. He said, well, since we learn all of Shvutin from the cases in Shabbos, then it seems like the exceptions in Shabbos should apply to other Shvutin as well. Except that the Chol HaMoed example seems to go against it. That's the way Rav Cook is writing about it. And many poskim, he points out, think that the question of doing malacha, of doing creative labor on Chol HaMoed, which is a problem, has many exceptions to it, but it's a problem. Many think that whole thing is Derabanan. If it's Derabanan, then speaking to a non-Jew about it is a Shvut Dishvut. Is it two Derabanan? It's the Derabanan of speaking to a non-Jew to do something prohibited for us, then the original prohibition is also Derabanan. That should be that all those things, therefore, should apply. So it seems then that his whole idea, that since Shavuot, the idea of Derabanan comes from Shabbos, and not speaking to non-Jews about things comes from Shabbos, so then they're the ones who created Amir La'akum, not speaking to non-Jews, you would have thought they would all be the same. That would have been his original assumption, and yet the example of Chol HaMoed seems to go against. And therefore, he offers another way to do it. Note that he doesn't say, and therefore the Jew shouldn't do it. He understands, especially, I believe that Rav Kook lived in a time in Eretz Yisrael where finances were seriously problematic, and so he's trying to find help for these people to do business if they have to. So he says, the deed with the non-Jew, or the agreement, the partnership agreement with the non-Jew, should read that he's giving him the money to do business, and the non-Jew should do business in whatever he finds. And if the non-Jew finds that his business is b'minim t'meim, and these things that are prohibited to do business in, and he's going to take his part in the business, so that he says, and the non-Jew is going to take part in the business, that he thinks is certainly okay, because you don't say that there's a shvut there, because the Jew is not telling the non-Jew what to do at all, and therefore it's okay, because we have this in other examples as well. For example, in Shabbos examples, and we, in our response today, have seen this before. We had a tshuva of the Noda Behuda about a non-Jewish employee in a Jewish store on Shabbos, and we discussed it there. I just don't remember the date of that tshuva anymore, but the point being that if you have a person, a non-Jew, who is working for a Jew, and they're doing business together, and the non-Jew is getting a percentage, a portion of the business, so then we say that what the non-Jew is doing for himself as much as for the Jew, and therefore is permissible. So the example that Rav Kook gives is if you have a non-Jewish aris, a sharecropper, so the sharecropper gets a percentage of the crop. That's the way it works. An aris actually pays a percentage of the crop to the Jew. So the non-Jew, let's say, will get 70% of the crop, and he'll give 30% of the crop to the Jew. So let's say the non-Jew farms on Shabbos, right? Or so that's fine, and the reason it's fine is because the non-Jew is doing it for himself, not for the Jew, and therefore it's okay. So if that's true there, it should be true for other purposes, such as our situation as well. So those two ideas, that one, since the non-Jew is profiting for himself, and two, the Jew is telling him that he can do business in whatever he chooses to and not laying out specifically what the business is, so he thinks that together allows enough room to create permissibility to do this. He also points out a Tosfos that says that in fact the whole idea of Shvut of Amir Lenochri didn't apply perhaps to other things. They never made exerv for that in Tzorech Gadol, let alone the original guess had been he was going to learn it from Shabbos, but he's saying there's also an opinion in the Tosfos that you don't have to learn it from Shabbos, that they never actually, just says straight out, that unless we know that they did, there's no general rule that they made a problem of Amir Lenochri in other situations. So with all of this together, Rav Kook thinks there's enough room for all that he's offered these possibilities. Though Rav Kook closes by saying, and we've seen this, Rav Kook do this before, that since he's busy, he wants to say he's not paskening unless other great rabbis of the generation will join him in this heter and this permissibility. He closes with only a couple of notes, so it's not enough to know exactly the topic fully, but he says he saw the Avbezdin of Tavrig, which I don't know where it is, but about a menorah. And the question is, when you're building a menorah, let's say you're going to build a menorah that looks exactly like the menorah that there was in the Beit HaMikdash, we don't permit such things because you're not allowed to build the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash unless it's going to be the kelim, the items in the Beit HaMikdash. So the menorah for the Beit HaMikdash should only be made exactly in that shape if it's actually going into the Beit HaMikdash. So he suggested that, well, what if it's all metal but mostly glass? But there's a lot of glass on top. The top things are of glass. So he says that since the majority of it, or the essence of it, is metal, then you're going to follow what the essence of it is, and therefore should be prohibited. But another option he talks about is that maybe if it's connected to the ground, it's not considered a kli because it's built right out of the ground. In any case, he doesn't finish up on that issue. He just raises a couple of points about that. So we'll stop there with the tshuva of Rav Kook about doing business, having a non-Jew do business for us in items that we ordinarily can't do business for ourselves. That's a problem because it's a shvut. It's a derabanan of not having non-Jews do for us that which we're not allowed to do for ourselves. That's generally true, not just in the case of Shabbos. Rav Kook suggests that, however, that just like Shabbos if the prohibition is derabanan, then it's called the shvut to shvut. It's a two-level, it's a two, twice removed from the actual prohibition. And once that's true, in cases of certain needs, that would be permissible. However, that's an ironclad idea, because Chol HaMoed, the example of having a non-Jew do malacha for us, doing work for us on Chol HaMoed, seems to go against that. So therefore, if Cook suggests that another idea would be to have the non-Jew to write the partnership agreement, such that the non-Jew has the flexibility, has the discretion to do business whatever he wants, and then if he chooses to do it in items that the Jew couldn't do business in it himself, that'll be the non-Jew's business, and that might make it okay. And then also the idea that if the non-Jew's getting benefit from it, that makes it better. So all that together, if Cook suggested, subject to other great rabbis agreeing with him, that would make it permissible. Now let's move on to a couple of tshuvot to the Nidra de Bihuda from the 11th of Tevet. The first one is from the 11th of Tevet of Tav Kuf Nun Bet, 1792. And this is shortly before he passed away. He says, and it's more than 9 months that I haven't been in my usual health, and my eyes aren't what they used to be. I mean, he's an elderly man by now, and he's really on the verge of passing away, although he doesn't know that. But he says, I wasn't really able to read well. And you wrote in very small letters. I wasn't able to read well. And then yesterday, and it's not clear to me why he didn't think of this before, but he says, yesterday I had somebody copy it over in larger writing. And you're asking about a certain man from Poland came to Hungary. This is quite a case. He marries a woman, and he doesn't mention when he got married that he has any brothers. The question of brothers is always an issue, because if a man from Poland comes to Hungary and, God forbid, passes away without children, the wife, if he has brothers, would need to have Yibum or Chalitza. And so she needs to know if he has brothers. She doesn't mention any brothers. Now, it could be that he had them and he didn't mention them, but he doesn't mention that any brothers. And they were married for more than 20 years, and they had a child, a son. And that son died, passed away in the lifetime of the father. So now, when the father passes away, as happens in this question, the wife, seems to need Yibum if he has brothers, the widow, the older widow, but this son had also gotten married in the time that he was alive, and then he passed away without any children. So a few years after the marriage, so they got married, he doesn't mention anything. A few years after the marriage, he says he had a wife in Poland, and when he had a wife in Poland, she left the religion. And remember, this is already the mid to late 1700s. You already have people leaving the religion. It's something to keep in track of, that we talk about the Enlightenment and leading to people leaving the religion. We've seen a couple of times that it starts happening already in the middle to the end of the 18th century, not just in the 19th century. So she left the religion, and she took with her their young son that they had together. And we don't know what happened to that son from that first wife. We don't know if he's alive and if he's still a mumar. The reason why it would be a question of whether he's still a mumar, there's room to say that she's not obligated, the wife to the son wouldn't be obligated to wait for Yibum or Chalitza, because there's a whole discussion in Halacha about whether if the only surviving brother is a mumar, has left the religion, whether or not that obligates in Yibum. That's not going to be fully our topic, because he won't get into it, but that's the reason why you mentioned that question. So, you have, man gets married, does not clarify, no, I'm sorry, let's just review. We have the man got married without mentioning whether he has a child, he or a wife, right? He doesn't mention any previous marriage or children. So she theoretically got married thinking that there's no problem Yibum or Chalitza here. They have a child. That also would mean she doesn't worry about Yibum or Chalitza. That child, that boy, got married. Then, sadly, that boy passes away. Sometime during all this happening, and it's over 20 years that all this is going on, sometime in those 20 years, he mentions that he did have a first wife. She left him because she left the religion. She took with him a son. That son, we don't know what happened to that son. And so, if she took him with him, that son might be a mumar, might not be observant, might not be connected to Judaism at all. And if that son is not connected to Judaism, that would be reason to think there's no obligation of chalitza for the deceased son's wife. And now this man has died, and this woman needs to know whether she needs Yibum or Chalitza, because if he left behind a son, maybe she doesn't. But if he didn't leave behind a son, she does. And we don't know if he has any brothers. So all of this, he said, many years after the marriage. So that be the reason why that's important, I think, is because the question is whether we any longer believe him about statements that he makes on these issues. So the question is whether these two wives, these two women, in the two generations, need a chalitza, and when they have to wait around until they find out where their yabam is, where the brothers to these people are. So The Note of Yehuda said, by the way, that when the man on his deathbed said he has a son, he doesn't know where he is. But the Note of Yehuda says it might be that it was a mistake in the responsum, and really it was supposed to be that he has a brother, and he doesn't know who it is. So we wouldn't know what to do with it. So Note of Yehuda suggests his answer is the wife of the father, right, the wife of the man who came from Poland to begin with, he thinks that she clearly can get married, mima nafshach. It's either way, because if we say you don't believe the husband, then she doesn't have any reason to think that he had any children, but also that he didn't have any brothers, because something he said had told her at the time of the marriage, they had either brothers or children. So if you don't believe him, there's no reason to think that he has, that she needs to a chalitz or a yibam. If you do believe him, he said he has a son. And we generally assume that if people identify a living person, we generally assume they continue to live. So this wife, this widow, would have the right to assume that the son back in Poland, who was taken by the first wife, is still alive, and therefore she doesn't need a yibum. But the wife of the son that they did have together, who sadly passed away, he thinks there it's much more of a problem. Because if she believes her father-in-law, we ask her. In other words, we ask her now, you might train her beforehand about what to say about this, but we ask her if she thinks that her father-in-law wouldn't lie about such things. So then, like the Shachar Yerideh says, she believes him, and therefore she's created a situation for herself in which she thinks that her husband had a brother back in Poland. That brother might be a mumar and might be dead, but had a brother, and therefore she has to wait to find out what the situation is, because maybe he came back to Judaism. So if she has a brother who came back to Judaism, if he had a brother who came back to Judaism, she needs a chalitza or yibum because her husband passed away without children. But if she says, I don't believe my father-in-law, so then the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch is that she doesn't have to wait around and she's allowed to get married because her husband did not have any known brothers. So that's the kula that he comes up with, right? The problem with that kula is, but he points out that the Maharit, who lived at the same time as the Shulchan Aruch, so he's an Acharon, but he says the Maharit had this long discussion in which the Maharit disagreed with everything the Note of Yehuda writes, and then the Note of Yehuda just writes, he's writing 200 years later, but he says everything the Maharit wrote has an answer to it. He doesn't get into it here, but he has an answer to it, and the Rosh, when he has a proof, he says that the Maharit had written the Rosh said it was prohibited, the Rosh certainly said it's permissible, and everything he writes about the Rush, I don't accept and I don't believe. In other words, even though the Maharit was 200 years before, the Rebbe was perfectly comfortable in this situation saying that he disagrees with the Maharit, and therefore he's passing the other way. He does point out the Beit Shmuel held that she would be prohibited. He thought the way Beit Shmuel read Rashi, the Ran, and the Milkei Yosef, held that the woman is prohibited, that she does have to wait and look around for. So therefore he says he thinks that if the woman believes her husband, her father-in-law, clearly she can't get married. But if she doesn't believe him, so then he's not willing to talk about it. And the reason that's a little bit, because doesn't want to paskin against the Beit Shmuel, which is interesting because he's willing to go firmly against the Maharit, who lived earlier than the Beit Shmuel, but not against the Beit Shmuel. Then he closes with another case where the man writing him said there was a man who had written married somebody else. He had married the Meneket Chavero, a nursing mother. So nursing mothers are an issue still today, but in Halacha, the Gemara, a nursing mother was supposed to get married for 24 months after she started until 24 months had passed from the time that she had the baby, because we want her to be able to nurse the baby. Today, how we have to listen to Halacha is complicated because it's not clear that nursing is as vital anymore. It's all sorts of issues come up. But in the case in the Note of Yehuda in the late 1700s, so she was nursing. He married a woman who was nursing after 22 months, and he didn't realize it. But he didn't realize that Esther, so it was a shogeg. They didn't realize they were doing the wrong thing. And a certain rabbi there had paskin that they don't have to. So normally the halacha would seem to have been that they have to separate until the 24 months is up. But since this Mora said that since they got married, bishogeg, they didn't realize it. They don't have to separate from each other. Note of Yehuda says, by the time you're getting this letter, since, as he said, he hadn't been able to look at it because he wasn't feeling well, the 24 months is up. I'm not going to write anything about it, but he thinks it's wrong. He thinks the guy got it wrong, and he wants them to know that if it ever comes again, they should really please contact him, basically, because it's wrong. He also says that in other cases where the brother is the Yabam is a mumar, with the brother is not observant, who it's for the brother of the man who passed away is not observant. He says that's not, it wasn't observant at the time of the wedding, or after the wedding. It's not a kula, because you have to worry that by the time the brother got married, maybe he wasn't a mumar anymore. Maybe he ran away from wherever his mother had taken him and he wasn't a mumar. Or even if it was a mumar, maybe you say it's be'ones, because he was already living among non-Jews and he couldn't change back because it was too hard, but he really wanted to, and therefore he thinks the Yibum issue and the Mumar aspect of it wouldn't have been a cool. So that's the end of that Shuvah Rabbi Yehuda, fundamentally about a man who all of a sudden reveals to us information we hadn't known before, and that information would cause issues both for the widow in the older generation and the widow in the younger generation. So there, the Rabbi Yehuda comes to believe that it's a question of, for the older generation woman, she doesn't have to worry about it at all, because there was no chazaka that he had a brother, and therefore she has no reason to believe that she is obligated to Yibum. And if she's going to believe that he had a brother, she should believe him that he had a son as well. And then still, she doesn't have an obligation in Yibum. So that wouldn't have been a problem for the mother. But for the daughter generation, if you believe the father-in-law that there was a son out there, then that son might be an issue, because she might have to find that son to see if she needs to do Yibum with him. And therefore, she has to worry about it, thinks that it would be Huda, unless she says she doesn't believe her father-in-law about it at all, and then he fundamentally thinks it should be okay. He's just not willing to say those words out loud, because he's not willing to go against the Beit Shmuel, even though he's well-willing to go against the Maharit. That's one note of Huda. Another note of Huda from Tuf Kuf Mem, which was still 1779. This is a brief tshuva on the note of Huda. He's writing back to a student of his, so he used the word Ahuvi Talmidi. When I was recording this in my computer to have it ready for us to study it together, I left out the date. So I just went up and looked up the date. So my first way to try to find this tshuva again, I just tried to search the words Ahuvi Talmidi, my beloved student. And it turns out there's almost 200 such times that Rabbi Yehuda refers to that phrase. So he says, you know that I've got that I'm very busy. I have a lot of students. I have a lot of people writing me questions and wanting answers to them. And therefore, I'm in a big city. And therefore, he says, I don't answer about the same thing twice. This is something we've seen before. I saw Rav Uziel had said it as well. It seems like, and I think I read somewhere that the Rabbi Kiva Eger had that idea too. There's like they make rules on their time. Because their time is so limited, they make rules that they're only willing to answer on a certain question one time, and then if they've already written about it, they stop answering it. But here, I think it's a beloved student, so he writes very briefly back. He says, you got it right. You paskin correctly. He's talking about liver. That what people would do is people would wrap liver in paper when they roasted it. So that's a problem. So there was some evidence. It was accepted that if you roasted a liver in its krum, in a sort of a membrane that was on it, we think that's still okay. The point of roasting liver is that liver is considered in halacha to be so filled with blood that you can't cook it, you can't salt it. Those won't remove enough of the blood or all of the blood such that the liver be kosher. So the way to prepare liver in halacha is you have to roast it. But as you're roasting it, you also have to make sure that the blood drips off and falls away. If you roast it in a pot where the blood pools, then the blood will be reabsorbed by the liver, and that won't work. So what if the liver is covered in something? So the halacha is, if it's covered in kind of a membrane, like a natural membrane, so there the halacha seems to be that it's okay, because we think the blood seeps through the membrane and therefore can drip away and can be gotten rid of. But if it's covered in paper, this student had written, in order to be disagreeing with him, and he says, lo kemosh katav ataz. So if you want to make a hierarchy, not that we're going to do this project together, but it's interesting to think about who are the authorities whom the Rinod Behuda is unwilling to go against, whom are the authorities he's willing to go against. We saw in the earlier tshuva that he was not willing to go against the Beit Shmuel, even as he was willing to say the Maharit got something wrong. And here, he's saying the Taz isn't right, even though, again, so I don't know what the respect that he has for the Beit Shmuel seems to be exceptional. But he says, he thinks a proof of it is that when you want to salt something, so we say that salting a bone works even for the marrow inside of it, right? You assume that any blood in the marrow inside the bone comes out as well. Even though, if somebody makes a kli etzem, like a pot or a pan made out of bone, we don't say that that bone is considered porous, such that anything that is in it will come out of it. We think that it's not porous. We say that it doesn't have any holes in it, and that's a problem. So how could it be that we say that the marrow, the blood in the marrow comes out by salting the bone. So he says the answer is that it depends on something, the difference between natural things and unnatural things. The bone is porous, whatever's in the marrow, because that's the way bone is made, and that's the natural formation of the bone. So here too, he says, when you roast a liver, so if the liver's in its natural crumb and its natural membrane, that's the way the liver is made, and therefore we assume and we understand that the membrane is porous to the blood inside of it. But if you put something else around the bone, around the liver, like paper, even though it's a moist paper, it's not porous to that, and therefore we have to assume the blood comes out will be held in by the paper, and therefore the liver would not be covered, will not be made kosher by this, and therefore you can't use it. And that is the second response of the Rabbi Yehuda for the 11th day. So for the 11th day, we had three quick tshuvot. Rav Cook on doing business with a non-Jew on items that the Jew himself is unable to take profit from. Rav the Rabbi Yehuda on the question of believing a man about whether he has a brother and sons with the Yibum ramifications for two widows in that case. And then the question of roasting liver if it's wrapped in paper. Those are some responses a day for the 11th of Tevet. Have a great day.